Well, hello, and welcome to Inside Vancouver Opera. My name is Ashley Daniel Foote, the Senior Manager of Partnerships, Engagement, and EDI. Bell Hooks said, "To be loving, we willingly hear the other's truth. And most important, we affirm the value of truth-telling. Lies may make people feel better, but they do not help them to know love." Today, Vancouver Opera is honoring Black History Month with a broadcast of a recent panel discussion that we hosted with Renaissance Opera. Debbie Wong, the founder and artistic director of Renaissance Opera, joined me as we spoke with Rocky Jones, Minnesota Opera's director of equity, diversity, and inclusion, Dawn Pemberton, otherwise known as Vancouver's own Queen of Soul, and Morgan Page Melbourne, a Toronto-based queer interdisciplinary artist. We were thrilled to host the discussion in Vancouver's historic Hogan's Alley, and we gathered in Vancouver's Strathcona Community Center on Kiefer Street. Our co-moderator, Debbie Wong, began the afternoon by talking a little bit about why we had programmed this event.
How do we center new communities, new voices that are especially erased in the operatic form, but then also the leadership that we do not see in our communities? This is our very first sort of step towards having new conversations about arts leadership, but also the impact of the arts within our cities and communities. I love you all so much. Why don't I start by introducing Morgan Page Melbourne? Morgan and I, it was so funny. I had been like secretly following her work for a long time. I was like, who is this amazing, multidisciplinary, classically trained, badass pianist, singer, songwriter, like filmmaker? And I was just so inspired by her work. And I think I was like literally looking up your work the day before. And then this email pops into my inbox like, "Hi, my name's Morgan Page. I've been following your work. I was wondering if we could chat." And this led to some collaborations, most recently having Morgan on a new hip-hop opera workshop that we've been doing. So I'm really excited to welcome you, Morgan.
Oh, so glad to be here. It's been such a fun experience so far. Like, Indie Fest is wicked. You'll need to check it out if you haven't done so yet. But so happy to be here.
In 2020, following the murder of George Floyd in Minnesota, Opera Minnesota transformed, I believe, or is on a path of transformation. And that's led by an incredible team, including Rocky Jones, who has been in the opera community for many, many years. And we are so deeply honored to have been able to bring Rocky all the way from Minnesota. And when I first started in this role, Rocky was one of the very first people that I reached out to, because I am honored and deeply awed by the work that you do at Minnesota Opera, Rocky, and just as a human. And on Rocky's podcast that he co-hosts with a great team called The Score, featured in the New York Times as one of Opera's most interesting up-and-coming podcasts, which, by the way, is a big deal. It's a big deal. Rocky, I think it's on an almost weekly basis, has fascinating guests and talks eloquently and passionately about the responsibility that we have. What are our ethical responsibilities as opera goers and as arts lovers in this time? And so I believe that, Rocky, you said this is your first time in Canada, so yes, it's our great honor to welcome Rocky Jones.
The honor is all mine, seriously. Thank you so much. Thank you.
We're also deeply honored to welcome Vancouver's Queen of Soul, the moniker that Dawn Pemberton. I first met Dawn at a concert with the gospel choir run by Gaitel Suderman. But of course, I've heard your music for years, and it was when I met you for the first time, I felt like I already knew you. And I recently was in Toronto and saw the work that you just music directed for Canstage Choir Boy. And it was so wonderful to see your work has gone cross country. And it's wonderful. The teaching, the music that you create is just such an inspiration. And we're honored that you had time in your packed schedule between going from coast to coast to jumping to the islands and performing. Dawn Pemberton, everybody.
Hello. So I'm curious, what is a moment of awe you've had recently, Morgan? You're yeah. looking at me with anticipation.
I probably would have to say, like, most recent was doing the hip opera, honestly. I think it's just the best part of it is being able to see everyone in their own element from so many different backgrounds, whether it's musically or ethnically, coming together and just creating something so brand new, off the cuff, just whatever feels like it is, we feel in the moment, and just seeing how beautifully it came together was something that's so inspiring, and it just brought me so much joy. And it just goes to show that there's so much we can do with opera in that case, and also just in any genre in general, of what's possible and what's out there. That's something that just, that was just so bloody cool.
Yeah, I guess for me, I think we did a recent episode of The Score, where we just got really honest about what it's like on a personal level doing EDI and access work as three Black queer people in Minnesota. And it always fills me with a quite a bit of awe that, like, you know, there are three Black queer people at an opera company who are, like, given space to, like, talk about our experiences and make decisions and actually have influence over the decisions that are being made at the company, which is not something that happens every day. But also, like, being able to, you know, I think when we talk about sort of, like, you know, inclusive, equitable opera, it feels like this thing that's going to happen someday. But, like, no, there are people who are doing that work right now, who are creating and making beautiful art and making just incredible, I mean, that's why we're all here, literally, right now. And so to be able to have those people on our show and to hear about the things that they're doing, to share their music, to share their art, every day, it's when I get to sit down with my two friends and whoever shows up that day to share whatever they're doing, it just fills me with this, like, wow, we get to do this. Like, this is awesome. This is incredible. So that's really fun to me. And it's kind of the best part of my week.
Wow. That sounds amazing.
It does sound amazing. I think, you know, maybe it's like the stage in my life, but I feel like I experience awe often, you know, and
that,
whether it's just like, look at that bird, oh my God, that's amazing, you know, to even more like concrete, I love communities forming and trying to transform the world. You know, I think that often brings a lot of awe in my life. Working on this show, Choir Boy, I was like, here are like 30 people trying to tell this really impactful story of five young Black men who are dealing with, like, you know, sexuality, toxic masculinity, privilege, all that stuff. And we're like, should their blazers be blue or yellow? You know, it's like, but like just the level of commitment to story and making sure that it's told well and that everything is intentional. Like, I just, that blows my mind, you know? I, from the smallest detail to the largest detail, I'm like, wow, that's so nerdy.
I love that. I love the idea of, like, or just the care with details that we can get into when we are in our work and doing our, be able to do our best work. I'm curious, there's a little bit of a theme here, and it's something that we've talked about, Rocky and Morgan, we're talking for the first time, but we kind of talked about empowered spaces or spaces of where we can be creative or fully creative, and I'm curious about that theme, if that sparks any ideas from any of you. Like, what does it mean to be in a space where you feel like you're accessing your full creativity?
I definitely feel pretty lucky enough and really grateful that I have been approached by amazing groups of people who want to actively make a change and be innovative with the way of storytelling through art and through music, whether it's blending multiple genres together musically or technically or in other art forms and bringing them all together. Because oftentimes that's not as common as you would think it would be. Mm. And so oftentimes I find there are a lot of companies who are scared to break those grounds of going outside the norm. Mm-hmm. And when you find a group of, like myself, I am a happily declared weirdo. When you find other groups of people who are cool to try weird things, yes, and explore that, it's like, yes, I want to be a part of that. Because that's something that will spark change, that will spark something so beautifully creative. And I think definitely being able to amplify those spaces are so important. And because right now, like, we are pretty much like a small community that is growing bit by bit every day, every month, every year. It's definitely showing something that needs to be changed, which is, it's just something truly beautiful to be a part of.
I was just going to say, you know, I think being empowered in space begins with feeling safe. You know,
yeah.
And I think as a, you know, a performer and of color, I feel like I didn't realize how much of myself and my needs that I would suppress when I didn't feel safe to ask for what I needed to do my job well. Mm-hmm. And recently, I had the pleasure of working with a predominantly Black cast a couple of months ago and a Black director, and the director was like, "What do you need? What do you need? Like, I'm here to advocate for you." And that was the first time that I was like, dang, like, I would just be silent. I would come to set with, like, my own hair stuff. He was like, "No, that's not right," you know? And I was like, "Oh, you mean I can ask for things?" He was like, "Yes," you know? So I think for me, I'm just being really mindful of, like, are people feeling safe to ask for what they need? And that's the beginning step to creating good art, yeah.
I think it's so interesting how very rare are those spaces are where we feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yes.
like, it's so much so that you can literally count it on one hand. Mm-hmm. It's like, how many of these performances or groups or companies I've been with where I actually feel like I know I won't be attacked, like, under the rug, you know,
yeah.
or indirect communication where I can't, like, I would fear what to say, and just purely for the fact of defending myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that is not talked about as often.
Mm.
And so when you're actually working with people that who look like you or who are within the same community as you, and you're all literally understanding the same thing and being a part of that, it's something so powerful, but it's so rare.
It's incredible. It really is. You know, when I first started, I started working at Minnesota Opera in 2016. And at the time, there were 3 people of color on staff. And I was the one Black person on staff. And I'm from Washington, D.C., y'all, and I don't know if you... Chocolate City. So that was a new experience for me. but, you know, in the 6 years that... Because we've actually, you know, been doing a lot of the work around... equity and inclusion and access since 2016. Fancy that. and in those in that time, you know, we've increased. I think it was something like 3% of our staff was folks of color, and now it's 30%.
Wow.
You know, 0% on leadership. Now it's 27%. And it's just so exciting to now walk into work and to see all of these beautiful melanated faces walking around the space and feeling safe and feeling. And I think what has changed, like, obviously, like, we're not putting the Mission Accomplished banner up anytime soon. It's still a very, you know, white occupied space. I don't like to say predominantly white because I feel like that implies some sort of, like, this is just how things happened, like, and it wasn't, like, centuries of, like, intentional decision-making. So, like, a very white-occupied space. But, like, all of these people, you know, we have instituted policies, you know, we're constantly auditing our systems and our procedures in order to be a much more inclusive and equitable organization, that people are really, like, committed to that it's a value and people understand that, like, values are our values. They don't change. We don't get to pick and choose when we live by our values. And so we've created a safer space. I'm not going to say safe, but like safe at least that, like, you know, people can come into our space and have the opportunity to succeed, but also, you know, it's also a safe place to even to fail, to try things, and that they're, even if things don't work out, like, you know, we had no idea when we started the podcast we were going to be in the New York Times. But, like, they were like, yeah, you know, here's some money, try it out, see what happens. So we sort of had the permission to fail, which I think, you know, not a lot of folks of color who enter these spaces get.
I feel like permission to fail, like, literally when you just said that, I was like, damn, I've always grown up experiencing life as if failure was not an option, you know?
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, you know, being a child of immigrant parents, being a Black woman, being a woman, like, it was like every time you show up and you show out, it's like, well, this is my one shot, like, you know, here I go, and I have to do it for the people.
Yeah.
And not that anyone deliberately said that to me, but it's like it's something that you internalize as a young child, and wow, you know, that's as heavy, as deep,
right?
Yeah.
No, exactly, because I will actually literally to the same point that both Rocky and Dawn are saying, like, growing up in an immigrant household, and anytime, like, just from yay high, where my parents would say, you have to work 1,000 times harder just to prove that you are good enough in these spaces. And it's like no room to fail, so it's like all kinds of pressure. And it's almost as if, like, if you fail, you look like you're at your worst. And you can't allow any room for exploration. Like, you have to do this to fit all of these boxes so you don't get put into the stigma or the stereotype. Which is so difficult, especially when that's put on a child.
Yes.
You know, that causes a lot of issues growing up and a lot of unlearning.
Yeah.
A lot of unlearning and trying to dissect things of what's happening. And I definitely, it wasn't until when I kind of left the heavy classical field going into contemporary and doing my own thing, where I felt like, you know what, I'm going to try this out. If it doesn't work, that's fine. And that's where, it wasn't until my adult years where I felt comfortable with allowing myself to fail, you know?
What's amazing about this panel is that all of us have a musical background and come from the musical milieu and trained, I think, in some ways very classically. And I want to talk about the innate white supremacism of classical music. And Rocky, you talked about that interesting dichotomy that exists in the space that you're in now, and I want to dig a little bit more into that. And Debbie, you've also talked about how you have felt exactly the same way about, as a leader of a company, that you have, you know, to fight hundreds of times harder in order to be, you know, seen and acknowledged. And I'd love if you could actually respond to that too.
I mean, there's a reason I started my own company, because I can't fit into other companies. And I like these ideas of trying to make spaces where people can feel empowered, and like acknowledging where I can't empower people and my own blindnesses and ignorances and things that I need to be learning and unlearning. Just, you know, it's been an interesting journey of like trying to be taken seriously. And now that I've had 5 years of running Renaissance Opera, I'm feeling like I'm invited into these new spaces with these arts leaders, and I'm noticing that it gets wider and wider and older and more male identifying. And there's sometimes when I'm in rooms where I'm the only person of color, for sure. I'm the only female identifying person. I'm the only person under 40. And this is like, to me, it's so heavy. And then the only reason I have been able to sneak my way in the back door is because I feel like I've had to prove myself over and over and over again, and there is no option to fail. There's zero. I cannot. I feel like I have to be excellent every single time, and I cannot misspeak. I can't lose my shit. I can't. You know. Mm-hmm. I don't have those permissions. I don't have it, and so it's a strange thing, but I'm also realizing, I said this to Rocky and Ashley earlier today, that I'm now, when I'm going into spaces, I'm asking myself the question, is this a space I have to be destructive in, or is it a space I can be creative in? And I'm choosing now to put my energy towards these spaces where I can be creative and empower others to be creative. And I'm in this mode of like, you know what? We're just going to build something else. We're going to do other things now. So we'll see how that serves better. But yeah.
Wow. It's definitely also the power of saying no and learning that and realizing that it's okay to do your own thing and you don't have to follow the status quo. Mm-hmm. You know, breaking out of that mindset, it takes a lot.
Morgan, you started, where you emerged as a prodigy at the piano. and the repertoire that you're playing, I'm sure, felt strange in some ways because of, you know, the construct of where it came from and how very colonial and you know, dyed in the wool it is, and it's something that we're exploring in opera. The canon is so wrought with so much. I would love it if you could talk a little bit about how you encountered that, how you processed that, and it's a big question. How do you still dialogue with that, like, perceived important repertoire that's required, it seems, you know, in the academy?
Okay, first off, like, growing up, like, definitely doing, I was in competitions, heavy-duty competitions for years, purely for classical romantic pieces. And luckily I had a teacher who was so sweet enough to let me do the composers who I felt most comfortable with. And of course, every so often she would like sneak in another one where it's not quite how I felt. But I did my best to always play like the composers who were the most rebellious, because that's I felt like I can connect with, at least on some level of some case. But then definitely once I got to contemporary, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm never going back. and of course, there are still times where I'm asked to perform certain pieces or certain works, but the context behind it is just written in racism and just so much terrible text. And I can't bring myself to do it anymore. And I think, of course, like, it's that rough road of having to face the necessary evil of, like, performing certain pieces until you get recognized for your work, and then you can have that decision to whether to follow that same path or not, and then you can go your own thing. But at the forefront of it all, I'm like, I'm not going to get involved in any of this, because it's also too, like, what I find is in opera, in like very traditional opera spaces, and even in traditional orchestral spaces, they want to focus so much on doing the exact same thing on the pieces and making sure it's based on historical fact, because it's the precious thing. It is the pillar of gold that we cannot mess up whatsoever. And so that includes the most horrendous stories that comes behind it, and it doesn't create a safe space. And just because, yes, there are works that we want to celebrate that are traditional, but that doesn't mean we have to perform them anymore. We simply can actually just stop it. Or if you absolutely feel like you have to do it, you can change the narrative and allow yourself to be open to do that. I'm actually part of a queer gender bending opera company called Opera Queens, and we make it a point to alter these stories so that it's POC friendly, to us LGBTQIA plus friendly as well, and we literally eliminate the racist story that would go behind it. And if we need to change some of the libretti, we will do that to kind of fit the current, like, the updated world that we are currently living in. We can still do the scores as is, the melody lines. We would keep that within the context, but really change it to kind of like go with how we are feeling in this moment, just to honor our own selves. Because it's almost like, because we're performing these words, it's almost as if we're going against our own beings of who we are. Yeah. And it's like, and we're attacking ourselves, you know, and it just, and then that leads us in this battle between of what's right, what's wrong,
like, who am I, and this whole self-identity crisis, and just in the music format alone. Mm. And it is something that's really interesting to see. So in that case, when it comes down to those things, it's more than okay to do that, I personally find. Or because there's also a beautiful array of contemporary music nowadays. There are living composers who need those opportunities, right?
Exactly.
We can do that. We don't have to do everything else, you know, because I've been involved on boards and committees, and they're trying to think, oh, how can we expand on audiences? How can we bring these people in? And I'm like, first off, you got to stop everything else that's actually going against these people, I guess, like people like myself, if you really want them to bring them in. Otherwise, that's contradicting the entire scenario. But of course, they just wanted me to be there as a trophy, just to say, oh, we have a black person, we have a black queer person on the board. So I'm like, okay, if y'all not going to listen to me, I will, goodbye. You know? So it's all intention.
You know, growing up as a mixed race kid on Vancouver Island, it's hard to see where you fit into the world of the arts. And it's in moments like this that I am reminded, and I'm joined in community, and it feels good. Dawn, I know you grew up here in Vancouver, and I'd love you to reflect on what that felt like for you as a budding performer, and how that still feels, you know, to walk through the spaces that you do.
Well, I can honestly say that, you know, I think everyone who is a performer will agree that there's something inside you that draws you and pulls you forward, propels you forward, and the search for connection, a search for creativity. And, like, thank God we have that, because if I didn't have that, then I would be, like, working at the bank or something. You know what I mean? So I think that in itself is, like, a gift, to have that hunger to just keep going. Definitely growing up in Vancouver, you know, it was a very, like, heavy metal. I mean, I grew up in East Fans. It was, like, heavy metal, you know, just tight jeans and long hair and T-shirts and Storm Rider jackets. So it felt like kind of hard to find people who are making music that spoke to my heart, and to find people who look like me who were doing what I was curious about doing. You know, luckily I had siblings who were kind of modeling that. They were out, you know, performing and making music. But I think I have missed a lot of opportunities because I didn't know what was possible. You know, and I remember having a teacher when I was in university who was like, you know, have you thought about opera? And I was like, huh? Like, what? She's like, I think you would do well. And I was like, oh, cool. And then I just never, like, followed up on it, you know?
Good choice.
Yeah. But part of it was, like, just not really seeing, you know, sure, there's, like, Cafe Battle and women, you know, Leontine Price, who were doing it, but I didn't think it was possible. And so I just remember, like, just trying to seek out just people who were doing it. And this is, like, you know, pre-YouTube and pre-internet and all that stuff. So it felt like this lonely quest. And, you know, I'm thankful for the path and the journey that I've been guided towards. But it definitely makes me think about my responsibility as a performer and, you know, a citizen of this community, just to, like, how can I show up for other people? And us living our lives is like a very radical act, and following what you love is a radical act. So I'm here to be radical.
I actually was curious, are there any questions from the audience? Yeah, Ian.
So my name is Ian Cromwell. I'm a performer in Vancouver. Also a classically trained musician, orchestral. I'm a viola player. And where I work now is contemporary music, is like pop music mostly. I can see sort of how the music that I make and the music that I appreciate is informed by sort of the classical background. For better or for worse, there is that sort of unlearning of that white supremacist framework, mm-hmm. and deprivileging certain forms of music over others. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that the panel could maybe comment on what opera as an art form offers to other forms of art. So, you know, talking about bringing our culture into operatic spaces, what does it mean to bring opera into other spaces?
Honestly, the way I view it, it's definitely not like, it's not just based on the style of singing or the techniques, but it's actually how an actual opera is framed. If you think about it, because of course there's like opera and musicals can kind of like somewhat go hand in hand. It's more so of the various aspects that kind of like bring opera together. Like you have like, you have your live band, or in this case, you have like a live orchestra, you have like a really heavy storyline, you have your character pieces. And I think bringing that into other spaces, like you can, mainly because I'm also in contemporary music as well, you can create that sort of storyline based on like a contemporary musical style, but then you can bring in various singers or various actors to kind of like portray that together. And then it's just a matter of what kind of opera companies would be interested in kind of like bridging those places. Definitely Renaissance opera is amazing for that. There's also tapestry opera. There's quite a few indie-based opera companies that I find are quite opening to bridging those two worlds together. Because a lot of it, it's storytelling. Another form of storytelling, in this case, a long form, because of course there are most operas can go up to an hour and a half, 2 hours. So it's just a matter of how you would structure that as like a contemporary musical space and how you put on that. But I find there's all forms, all shapes and forms of how that could be bridged. An example, one of the ways that I did it, one of my first experiences was with tapestry opera, and we turned it into a short film instead. Oh. So we created a storyline, because I am really bad with coming up with storylines for things. It's like, I'll just do the music. Y'all can figure out whatever you want to go with. So we were able to collaborate on that aspect. We recorded it live. We shot and filmed everything based on the scenes and how we wanted to flow, and we turned that into a film. And so in essence, it's like a dramatic opera, but with alternative pop, contemporary rock music involved in it. And we submitted it to film festivals and won awards, and it was a cool experience. So that's definitely one of the examples that could be done with that.
There's like a bit of cachet in privacy and or exclusivity that happens with when you're involved in a style of music. And it's like, well, I'm really smart because I understand this. And, you know, this makes me a little bit more special than you because you don't. And I think, this is so dangerous, you know? And I think we need to like break that down. Yes. That needs to be annihilated, right?
Yes.
And it's starting to happen, right? One is by having subtitles in spaces where opera is being performed. It's like, this is in Italian. Not everyone's Italian, so I need to know what's happening, you know? And like things like that need to happen. It's like, oh, we need to do opera in unusual spaces. Mm-hmm. We need to bring it to the people. And I think once we kind of deconstruct the gatekeeping, and make it less like you're special because you understand this or you can afford to go to this. That's a key to opening the world up and making people realize like, oh, I have a lot in common with this art form.
I'm going to just jump in with a thought, and that is that we've been working with a group of Musqueam students who, when we invited them to come to the Queen Elizabeth Theater, they were kind of surprised at just the scale of everything and the canvas that we play on in terms of uniting all of, you know, this fantastic, these artists that come together and work with design, with the musicians, with the singers and storytellers all brought together. And they're like, we would love to be able to create on this scale, to tell stories that matter to us on this spectrum. And I think that, you know, it's something at Vancouver Opera that we are very serious about welcoming and opening that big canvas up, so it's not just this one big room that performs these remote works. But I believe there is a strong argument to be made that the art form is all about bringing folks together across so many different areas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also mixed race. I think I was like 14 when I learned I wasn't white. And it was just like people are looking at me differently, think differently about me. So when I was growing up, I was trained in classical music. So in a lot of ways, that's like the framework through which I understood how to use my voice and how to sing. And as I went through my studies, I just like, it got heavier and heavier. And I'm like, oh my God, what are these stories? What am I doing? What am I doing? This culture, what am I doing? There's no one who looks like me in any kind of leadership and any stories that we're telling. And finally, when I said no and stepped outside of the box, I began to realize that, like, if I look at it on a very surface level, there were like tools of collaborating that I learned from classical music and opera, and also I was drawn to it because Western European opera was inspired by multidisciplinary collaboration, a whole bunch of different people that came together and were like, how can we transform storytelling? And so the question that, you know, we have this talk all the time, like, does opera belong in our company name? Like, do we just need to drop that because it's creating a barrier for folks? And it is. Mm-hmm. So we think about that a lot. But for myself, because it's like, you know, it's my own kind of like, it's something that's been a part of me for so long. But understanding and experiencing it as a radical act of collaboration, and part of that is dismantling like the inherent power structures that are in it already. But being able to work through those and work with all these different artists has been really powerful. It's been a really useful tool. And when you were talking about super titles and things, and Morgan, you were talking about co-creation. One of the things I was thinking about too is just how we communicate musical language. Mm-hmm. And you know, in classical music, there's all this like and also in Western European cultures, there's such an impetus on writing and reading and literacy. Mm-hmm. And all of these mm-hmm. things. But many of us come from cultures and traditions of oral storytelling, of oral yes. knowledge, of understanding the world and understanding our ancestral knowledge through other means of communication. Mm-hmm. And even in this most recent workshop we keep talking about, there were no scores. Like, yes, there were written words, so we did have that, but there was no musical notation, there was nothing. And I learned more about vocal pedagogy, like how my voice and body works from the beatboxer than I did through like 15 years of university in voice studies. Like him just explaining how he's making sound. I was like, oh my God, I've never even thought of that before. So there are seeds there that can be expanded on and re-sown to create something new, I think.
Sure. Yeah. I think actually just kind of like playing off of what you were saying about should we change the name because of the opera or whatever. I feel like it's almost you're reconstructing it to fit what it means to you, like as a sense of reclaiming that because of like the heavy whitewashing and constructive matter that it was in. But there's just so much more to it than what people are used to seeing. Mm-hmm. And I think it creates a such a broader perspective that's something that can be, you know, explored and explained. So I feel like it still pretty much fits it, but it's just a matter of, you know, it's definitely being radical in that idea that yes, this is what it is and we're proud to use it that way and this is how we view it.
Yeah, you know, I was I guess I must have been 8 or 9 years old, and my mother actually went to Howard University, and one of her sorority sisters was Jessie Norman. Wow. I know, right? My one little bit of nepotism. And so she was giving a concert at the Kennedy Center, and we went, and you know, like my little 8-year-old mind was just blown, sitting there in the audience, and like there's the Jessie Norman, like doing her Jessie Norman thing, blowing everyone's wigs back. And then like after the show, like now she's talking to my mom and she and she's saying hi to me and what's going on. And that was the moment where I was just kind of like, oh cool, oh so we can do this. Like not only like humans can do this, but humans that look like me can do this. And so that is one of the, you know, those formative moments that for me, you know, I grew up you know, just feeling like, oh, yeah, this is a thing for me. This is a space for me. And so I really want to be able to sort of create that for other folks. You know, representation is just so important. It just, you know, it can change our, like, that's the reason we're all in this space together. At some point, opera or classical music or just music, just art, you know, changed our lives. Mm-hmm. Changed the trajectory of all of our lives. And so I just want to, you know, be a part of that. And I just think, like, to everyone's point, like, opera just has this incredible collaborative sense. And it can be radical. And so, like, whatever we want to call it, if we want to call it opera, if we don't want to call it opera, like, whatever. But, like, that bringing people together, to me, is the most exciting thing.
So the name of our panel today, it's kind of a long one, but there's a part of it that I'm particularly drawn to, and I want to ask everyone, giving voice. And I would like, you've all given beautiful voice today, but I would like to ask for more. But when you hear the term giving voice, I'd like to, like, ask the question, is there anything that you would like to give voice to today more than you already have? Or is there a way that you would like to give voice?
I'm thinking a lot about what I need to do to lift up the next generation of arts leadership. And there's a lot of times when I just want to be like, yeah, I'm done here. Like, I need to go to bed. But then I look at the artists that are coming up, the generation behind me. And even though, like, I might be stuck in these spaces that just are exhausting, I'm happy and joyful to be there because I want those spaces to transform, and I want to open and create and build new spaces for the next generation of racialized artists to thrive and grow and create within. So I want to give voice to those amazing arts leaders, those mentors, the younger generation of mentors that I feel like should reflect to me what I need to see in the world and in the future. So that's what I'm giving voice to.
And Debbie, you do that every day as an arts leader. That is you are the embodiment of giving voice. So I just want to acknowledge the work, the tireless and very exhausting work that you do. So big ups to you, Debbie.
You know, I think I feel very committed to just, like you said, lifting up younger performers. But I feel like it's this intense, I don't know, life or death thing for me right now, where it's just like, I think it's really important for people to know how capable they are and how much power they have to impact the world. And I was working with a group of young singers, I don't know, the other day, what is time? And and I just, you know, they were like very skilled singers, like just like, you know, singing their faces off. But there was just this theme of, like, you know, like not claiming space and not stepping into their power. And I was like, yo, like, what are you doing? Like, stop that right now. Like, I'm telling you, just you being here is like, you're worthy, right? Like, it's just like, I felt angry. Like, I felt like very angry. Not at them, but just that they grew up in a world that told them that they were powerless and that they had nothing to offer, and that what they were giving was never going to be good enough. And I was like, fuck that. Like, stop it. Just stop it. Like, it's a choice. You know, we've been told one thing, and that's all lies. And it's a choice to be impactful. It's a choice that we can, like, really turn it up and, like, tear shit down and knock people out with our voices and with our artistry. So, I feel very excited about that.
Yes! That's how I feel when you sing, by the way. When I hear you sing. Yes.
I think what's been on my mind a lot lately, so in 2019, I was getting a lot of questions from folks that were like, why do we need to, like, come into work and talk about our identities? Like, how does that contribute to an equitable opera? And it was just like, and so I set out to never have to answer that question ever again.
Ooh.
And, you know, created a document, which we call our diversity charter, which commits our company to being an anti-racist and anti-oppressive opera company, which is the first, as far as I'm aware, of its kind, kind of anywhere. And so really, like, since that was ratified unanimously in 2020, it went through the whole legislative process through the company. My job has really been figuring out how to implement that and really, like, what does that actually mean and what does that look like? And I think right now I'm coming to the realization that it doesn't mean an opera that's free from racism entirely, unfortunately. But it does mean an opera where we are acknowledging the racism. We are interrogating that racism again and again and again, and providing space for more opportunities for global majority minoritized folks to come in and create, that we're auditing our systems and procedures and rules and whatnot, and that we're actually I feel like the next frontier of this work, after 2 years of COVID, this mass disabling event, is we're going to have a whole bunch of people who are going to be disabled coming up for the next couple of years. And the next frontier is really, like, how do we tackle that? How do we think about that? And how do we create more accessible spaces for those folks? So, kind of a lot, but that's what's on my mind lately a lot.
So. I'm definitely thinking quite a bit of authenticity and representing authenticity, and not being afraid to show that, because I've experienced having to hide myself for quite some time, either to please others, because, having to unlearn people pleasing, that's definitely one thing that took a long time, and allowing myself to be how I am and who I am in my truest form, whether it's through my music and how I interpret that, how I communicate with others, what it is that I expect for myself. I want to be able to share that with others and see that that's something that you can do. Mm-hmm. And you hold so much value within that. You shouldn't have to be afraid to be your most authentic self. There is so much power that you can wield in that. And you can manipulate it however you want to fit what it is you need for yourself. And you take that space and you go for it. Because I definitely can relate to Dawn when seeing, people just not too sure of what's happening. It's like, you have so much to give. Mm-hmm. And I want to see you do that. And yeah. I can, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's really heartbreaking. And it's definitely that, I feel like as of right now, that's probably something that's definitely on my mind.
Well, one thing I would love us all to do somehow is to give voice together, and I'm wondering if I could request Dawn maybe to sing just one note, and then we could all close our eyes and sing with Dawn together.
Sure.
Just for a moment. Yeah. Just to have that experience. I have a strong feeling that it will be a special experience. So
definitely.
So if Dawn, if you can do the honor, then we'll take a listen, and then we'll do our best to join in. Another harmony note with it, that's fine too. Just breathe whatever you need.
Oh my goodness, what a special moment to be able to be there in Black Strathcona, Hogan's Alley, with Debbie Wong, Morgan Page Melbourne, and Dawn Pemberton, and Rocky Jones, as we talked about all of those incredible things. Thanks for listening. Inside Vancouver Opera will be back soon with more stories behind the curtain and interrogating our art form. I'll see you at the opera.